You can subscribe to The Spectator for 12 weeks for only £12 for our print and online editions, plus get 6 months of digital access free to The Telegraph. Go to spectator.co.uk/telegraph.
Hello and welcome to Spectator Out Loud. Every week we pick a few of our writers for them to read their pieces out to you. This week we're going to be hearing from Matthew Paris about how, when it comes to free school meals, he's truly fallen out with the zeitgeist. We'll also be joined by Lionel Shriver, who reads her piece about why she's going to vote for Biden, warts and all. And at the very end, Douglas Murray updates us on a notebook from America where he's been for the last few weeks. First up, Matthew Paris.
Moments arrive when it becomes clear you're losing the zeitgeist. Whatever might be the spirit of the era, you just don't get it anymore. For me, such a moment occurred last week as I followed news and commentary about the footballer Marcus Rashford's campaign for meal vouchers for disadvantaged children during the school holidays. A Nottinghamshire Conservative MP, Brendan Clark-Smith, MP for Bassett Law, had spoken in the Commons debate. Where is the slick PR campaign encouraging absent parents to take some responsibility for their children? He asked. I do not believe in nationalising children. Brilliant, I thought, and so well put. Of course, I don't believe that all children who go hungry do so because their parents can't be bothered. There will be as many different circumstances as there are deprived families. But ever since I tried living on the dole as an MP in the early 1980s, I've known that you can eat healthily very cheaply. What caused my downfall in that programme was paying, as my TV bosses demanded, to attend a football match. Help and advice with getting priorities right, budgeting and preparing inexpensive meals is tremendously important, especially for disorganised families. But as Clark-Smith suggested, such a campaign wouldn't tug the heartstrings as easily as Rashford's celebrity-led operation has done. A famous, public-spirited and very likeable footballer could do much for a healthy living on a tight budget campaign, but it's easier just to crusade for the government to give people more money. As for the phrase nationalising children, I thought the MP was spot on. Nearly 4 months ago, when Rashford's proposals were first resisted, then accepted by government, I wrote for The Times, arguing that ministers had lost their footing and must finally slide all the way to the provision of meals or vouchers for poorer children all year, in or out of school. Why for summer but not for Christmas, I asked, and how about the winter clothing of poorer children? It may take years, but that's where the logic leads. I still think that. And what about the under-fives who don't even go to school if their older siblings are to get meal vouchers? How do we resist the argument that meals should be provided by the state for all children from poor families? So when I read Clark-Smith's Commons remarks, I expected that the MP would get good support from many. That's what I mean about missing the zeitgeist. The world came down on Clark-Smith like a ton of bricks. He was quoted on the BBC as though his remarks were an obvious gaffe. He hit a storm of social media abuse. So did almost anybody who put their heads above the parapet to question the logic or wisdom of the Rashford campaign. I was startled by the apparent failure of almost anyone to make the sceptical case. At which point you may think I would have seized the opportunity to use what platform I have to do this. And you'd be wrong. One of the big BBC radio programmes phoned. They'd read my earlier Times piece, would I now make those arguments again, this time on air? I thought about it, and heard myself saying this. Sorry, but I don't want to lose what remaining friends I have. There's a gale force prevailing wind against my argument. It's a lost cause, so I can't see the point in just sounding nasty on the radio. Forgive me. Then Newsnight rang, then BBC Radio Scotland, then the News Channel. Researchers were obviously desperate to balance the Rashfordites. That's what everyone's saying, they lamented when I declined. Can you think of anyone reasonably articulate who'd give us a bit of pushback to the meal vouchers campaign? I honestly couldn't. Well, I'd reply, there's a range of ghastly old grizzled mean bastard Tory MPs who'd do it for you, I suppose. Yes, that's the problem, the researcher would remark. We're looking for someone who isn't one of the usual suspects. Well, it wasn't going to be me. Not this time. I'm ducking. I can't just rewrite my July Times column. I've said all that already. In writing this for The Spectator, I'm comforted to feel myself in the company of a body of readers, many of whom will appreciate my argument. Strange that, but true. Alone with a cup of coffee at my desk as rain spatters the window, it does make a difference. But you're not typical, believe me. You and I are missing the zeitgeist. Two questions arise. Should we ourselves stick to our guns and fight on? And should the Conservative government fight on? As to the second, I begin to wonder. This could have been handled so much better and should have been anticipated. That universal credit has been increased by £20 per week, school day, holiday, every day, seems to have passed unremarked. The only really persuasive voice I've heard on the Today programme last Saturday was that of the Conservative MP David Simmons, who didn't sound mad or mean and really knew his stuff. But the initiative has been lost, and I suspect the worldly wise advice to government is that this is not a ditch to die in. But which ditch, then? Should you or I, with no need to be re-elected, surrender to the spirit of the age? I don't know. I can only quote Thornton Wilder, writing in The Bridge of San Luis Rey about an 18th century abbess who believed in women's equality. She was, says Wilder, one of those persons who have allowed their lives to be gnawed away because they have fallen in love with an idea several centuries before its appointed appearance in the history of civilization. She hurled herself against the obstinacy of her times. Unlike the abbess, we shall not have to wait several centuries to make the argument for personal responsibility, but I fear it may be quite some time, and I weary of hurling myself against things and sounding mean.
That was Matthew Paris, and now Lionel Shriver.
I just spent £2.50 in postage to bring about one of the last things I want. Specifically, the next to last thing I want. If the polls are right, and how should I know, my absentee ballot will help leave Trump behind as a one-term historical aberration and install as U.S. president an elderly Democratic lifer whose cognitive capacities remain uncertain. Many an ambivalent Biden voter will share my concerns about victory. COVID. Who is that masked man? Biden often flaunts his face coverings even when nowhere near another human being, while his party has embraced the mask as a badge of nobility, righteousness, and partisan unity. Obliging computer modelers now posit that more than 100,000 COVID deaths could be prevented if 95% of Americans always wore masks. These dubious figures can't possibly be substantiated. Due to ethics concerns and logistical challenges, no large controlled study on how well masks protect others from infection has ever been conducted, so the model's inputs must have assumed the conclusions. That's right next door to, if you will, barefaced lying. Yet Democrats' faith in masks is absolute. Horribly, a national mask mandate could be in the offing, perhaps in place for years. Worse, Democrats are in love with lockdowns. Still more chloroforming of the U.S. economy would be catastrophic. Come hither, immigration. The Biden plan for securing our values as a nation of immigrants overwhelmingly stresses welcome wagon over enforcement. His roadmap to citizenship for illegal immigrants translates as amnesty. Even Trump hasn't significantly stanched rampant violation of American immigration laws, and historically high levels of deportation is one Obama policy that Biden is likely to dump. The handful of Democrats like me, who advocate stemming illegal immigration while encouraging more high-skilled legal immigration, long ago lost out to the de facto open borders crowd. Time to finally learn Spanish. Supreme Court packing. Biden has refused to rule it out. Now, I'm pro-choice. Nevertheless, court packing is the stuff of banana republics and demagogues. As we like to say now, not a good look. Incontinent spending. According to analysts at the Wharton School, Biden's policies would add $5.4 trillion to federal spending over 10 years. Twice the size of Hillary Clinton's, Biden's prospective budget entails the largest proposed spending increase by a presidential nominee since George McGovern, says a Wharton economist. And the promised spree doesn't include those inevitable stimulus packages to drag the states out of its lockdown black hole. More made-up funny money, more debt, more house of cards, structural instability. Higher taxes. Trump's tax reform was hasty, messy, and for high-tax Democratic states, spiteful. But cutting the corporate rate was economically savvy. Biden will bung it right back up. As for his promise not to raise taxes on anyone earning less than $400,000, balderdash. Whenever legislators get down to the nitty-gritty, thresholds plummet, thereby reaming the middle class. Because otherwise, tax hikes just don't raise enough revenue. The unleashing of the hard left. Biden won the nomination as a centrist. But his new little friend Bernie is whispering in his ear. And among the Democratic Party elite, the wokesters are ascendant. Encroaching physical frailty readily crumbles the backbone. How effectively will Biden hold the line against the lunatics on his own side? When in the last debate he genuflected towards systemic racism, my heart fell. If Biden is inaugurated in January, Trump's unusually sane directive that federal agencies not promote critical race theory might not last beyond Valentine's Day. President Harris. Given Biden's age, the likelihood that he doesn't complete a first term is uncomfortably high. Yet Kamala generated so little enthusiasm during her primary campaign that she had to drop out before anyone got a chance to not vote for her. I doubt I'm alone here. She has a superior, snide, and scornful manner that grates. Conspicuously picked for VP to tick the right identity boxes, she's already demonstrated eagerness to play the divisive race card, even on Biden himself. Arguably immaterial, sure. But I can't stand the sound of her voice. If the prospect of a Biden administration fills me with such foreboding, why did I just vote for the guy? I'll spare you the standard foam-at-the-mouth diatribe about Trump being a threat to democracy itself, and keep it short. The man's incompetent. And Biden has upsides. His health care plan beats no health care plan. A president who has occasional verbal lapses beats a president who can't talk at all. Biden might halt the attrition of qualified civil servants from every branch of government while improving his country's international standing, at least from knee-high to mid-thigh. Biden's very dullness could restore a sense of order. Rather than build back better, his slogan might more persuasively have run, "Make America boring again." Cherry on top, returning Trump to a fading reality TV star would deprive the far left of their most beloved punching bag, for this ultimate emblem of evil and stupidity has proven the left's most potent recruiting tool. Believe me, if the Donald loses, progressives will grievously miss that fat orange face. On my absentee ballot, I did do something mischievous. Whimsically, I voted for the wrong party for Congress, the only Republican I've ever voted for. Although my eccentric gesture won't matter, my New York district is fated for a Democrat. It's just that I don't fancy the same party completely controlling both the legislature and the White House, thus being free to do whatever they please. I prefer a constraining influence at play. Should the Democrats take the Senate, I'll be uneasy. But hey, I'm bound to feel glum in any event, because my only options are getting pretty depressed and getting suicidally depressed. I've no champagne chilling for the 3rd of November, even though I presently expect to win. Yeah, I do think it's crucial to get an erratic, inflammatory, poorly informed buffoon who never reads anything out of the Oval Office. But I've no rosy illusions about a Biden presidency. So, rather than bubbly, I'm thinking vodka neat. Cold. Make that a double.
That was Lionel Shriver, and last, Douglas Murray.
American Notebook by Douglas Murray. Earlier this summer, left-wing activists announced a semi-autonomous zone in the Capitol Hill area of Seattle. Denuded of law enforcement and any other signs of the American state, these activists deluded themselves that they were creating a blueprint for the perfect society. After a number of wholly predictable murders and rather more rapes, the state retook control. The area where the state formerly known as Chaz briefly stood is now just another homeless encampment, overlooked by empty luxury apartments. Local businesses are suing the city for failing to protect them. All still have "Don't Hurt Me" signs in the windows. One, a hairdresser, stresses that it is a minority-owned, women-led, LGBTQIA+ staffed local business. What any business in the area might do if it is unfortunate enough to be owned or staffed by people from a majority. What any business in the area might do if it is unfortunate enough to be owned or staffed by people from a majority group is not to be imagined. Like most other businesses in town, the local Whole Foods is boarded up against rioters. Over this unprepossessing edifice, Whole Foods has hung a huge banner of its own which proclaims, "Racism has no place here," as though the Seattle Whole Foods was ever suspected of hosting Klan meetings in the dried fruit and nuts aisle. Even the local ice cream parlour has a side business selling T-shirts for the National Association for the Advancement of Coloured People. Seattle, like Portland, is like living in a one-party state, in which the state religion is BLM. Pensacola, Florida, is different, and not just because Air Force One is soon to arrive. In the airfield where it will land, thousands of people stream through the metal detectors and await the main act. It is hard to know whether the warm-up songs blasted out through loudspeakers have been chosen with too much thought or none at all. My Way, Losing My Religion, Rocket Man, and Don't Stop Believing can all be interpreted in several ways. Gounod's Ave Maria is abruptly interrupted to make way for Florida's governor, Ron DeSantis. The theme song from Titanic is played twice. And YMCA, which has become the theme song of the re-election campaign, comes on before the president's arrival. The crowd is thrilled, dancing about with joy. One of the addresses ahead of the president is from a pastor who prays for the re-election of Donald Trump. He says he believes that because of what the president has done for Israel, another normalization treaty signed that day, Trump will be rewarded eternally. It summons up the disturbing image of the world's humblest arriving into heaven to find themselves greeted by the man who recently introduced himself as your favourite president. The plane has landed, and the world's most famous head of hair heaves into view. The audience remains on its feet throughout his hour-long speech. Although I am standing among them, taking notes and admitting I am from the media, everyone is warm and welcoming. Certainly, they are here for the tough stuff. Right to bear arms, defending the police, and patriotic, not America-hating, education. But they are also here because of something the media rarely admits. The president is funny. When he slings nicknames at his opponents and otherwise goes off script, both he and the crowd get to enjoy themselves. In the segment about the China virus, he starts talking about the period after he tested positive for corona. What the hell was all that about, he asides, as if he is as bemused as anyone else by the reality show around him. It is his weakness and his strength. His freewheeling indifference to political norms attracts many of his supporters, some of whom say they never voted before. But, as the great Peggy Noonan recently wrote, the nation may also be tiring of the 24/7 reality show and wish to change the channel. Such voters hope Joe Biden will bring back normal. The laptop from hell is how the president describes the device Joe's son Hunter forgot to pick up from a computer repair shop and which ended up in the hands of Trump's associate Rudy Giuliani. The contents include emails that suggest Biden's son spent recent years enriching himself and possibly his father abroad through holding out his family connections. The laptop also contains photos and videos of Hunter smoking crack, exposing himself, and being pleasured by the foot of an unknown person. The Democratic Party and most of the media wish to protect the Bidens and are still claiming the laptop is a Russian interference plot. Elsewhere, much fun is being had with the I can't look, show me elements of the sex leaks. Yet Republicans should beware of this. The corruption and cronyism scandal risks being drowned out amid the sex. Besides, in the digital age, nobody's children are more than a few clicks away from some embarrassment. Plus, nobody could mistake the Republican candidate for Snow White. Though exactly who he is remains both strange and wholly transparent. When YMCA comes back on after his speech, the president manages not only to move his hands in time to the music, but even dares a little hip wiggle and sway of the legs. So, amid the floodlights, the evening ends in signature style. With militarism and camp, deadly seriousness and palpable insincerity. Perhaps this is normal. Perhaps nothing ever is.
That was Douglas Murray. Thanks for listening to this episode of Spectator Out Loud, and you might have heard a thing or two about our podcast survey. If you haven't, it's what it says on the tin, really. Take a few minutes to tell us what you think of our podcast, how you came to us, and whether or not you subscribe to the magazine at spectator.co.uk/podcast survey, or one word, and you would be in for a chance to win a free bottle of Paul Roger champagne. Thanks for listening, and join us again next week.